Professor Amaury Lambert is a mathematician leading a research group called SMILE for stochastic models for inference of life evolution, hosted at the Collège de France in Paris. He is also a professor at the École Normale Supérieure in Paris. His research spans the fields of population genetics, evolution, and speciation, which his group studies via the use of probabilistic and stochastic models, including branching processes and coalescent theory tools. In this conversation, we explore how to model the emergence and disappearance of biological species, the use of mathematics and phylogenetics, and more generally, we discuss the ability of mathematics to model biology. Mathematically speaking, how would you define a species?
Mathematically speaking? That's a very interesting question. So, you know, the biological species concept says that a species is a group of individuals that can interbreed, but cannot interbreed with other such groups. So even this definition, which is really how most biologists see species, is a recursive one, right? It appeals to itself to define species. And so really there's a mathematical notion which is hidden behind. And the notion is as follows. So if we assume that all individuals extant at the same time can be linked to each other by an edge, okay, think of a graph, by an edge which is present if and only if these two individuals can interbreed, okay? Mm-hmm. And then if you assume that two individuals that can interbreed are in the same species, and two individuals that can interbreed with someone with which they can both interbreed, like a third individual, then they are in the same species, then the biological species concept tells you that a species is a connected component of the interbreeding graph that I just defined. So connected component, you have to imagine that it's individuals, so vertices in the graph that are linked to one another by a path, right? And so if you visualize your graph from far away, then you see that these connected components are like isolated from each other, but these are, you know, the pieces of the graph that are connected, but not connecting to each other.
Yeah, so mathematically speaking, the kind of properties that you need for a species are maybe different than what's useful in biology. So in biology, you would want something that's observable based on phenotypes. But for your purposes for modeling, what kind of like properties are really useful?
So the problem with the definition I just gave is that it's quite difficult even in the field to know whether two individuals are in the same species based solely on their ability to interbreed, right? Because you have to assume that you can do crosses and just test all the possible crosses, etc. And so basically there are proxies for the ability to interbreed that are used in biology or also in modeling sciences is either the phenotype, as you said. So the idea would be that individuals that are closely related to each other, I mean, or that resemble each other are in the same species. But of course that can be be meaningless because there are, you know, what is called evolutionary convergence, the fact that individuals that are for totally different species may be very similar to each other. A very famous example is between mammals and marsupials. It's common to say that for each mammal species, there's a marsupial species which corresponds to it and that matches all the phenotypes. And so what we use basically is more like the genealogical proximity. Okay, so if you think of the tree life or the tree of all individuals, if you think of for example, you can follow the mitochondrial DNA of all individuals, and that makes a tree. Okay, and if you think of this tree, and you want to cluster together all individuals that are that form a subtree of this big tree, then that can give you a way of clustering individuals into species. And actually, there's a common way of doing this, which is called the OTU, Operational Taxonomic Unit, which amounts to clustering all individuals that are that whose genetic distance between the two is inferior to 2%. So that's basically, you know, operational criterion that allows you to cluster genomes into species, even if you don't know whether they can interbreed or not.
Is it quite consensus to use that 2% threshold? Because I suppose if you decide to base similarity based on, or like to rank based on similarity, you can place the threshold where you want. And how do you decide how the level of granularity you want to put in the species?
Yeah, you're totally right. So I think that this threshold is based on like an empirical you know, previous experiment, previous use of you know, species that we know are species, and basically this threshold is not universal, but is empirically what is found, you know, to separate, you know, individuals that are, of course, the notion of interbreeding is only you know, true or useful for species with sex, and so for all types of microbial species, it's not the right criterion, and so 2% quite works in the sense that, you know, there are still like kinds of sex between, you know, non-sexual species, like, you know, horizontal gene transfer, and this so we know that horizontal gene transfer like decreases with divergence, and basically falls quite sharply for many species after 2%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's probably quite important to make the distinction between like more complex species and bacteria, but even like within microbes, if you look at viruses, using the word species, I guess, is not so straightforward with them. And we typically use the word quasi-species because they have this like swarm of mutations, but even a given set of sequence diversity in bacteria is just very different orders of magnitude than to viruses. So I wonder if you like kind of applied your species definition to the viral kingdom and whether that's worked out.
I don't know if like people would do that to viruses. Yeah, I have no answer actually. I don't know, but I guess that it wouldn't work, right?
Because obviously we do use the words OTU, operational taxonomic units. You see a lot referring to bacteria, like in microbiome papers. I think that'd be interesting to see with viruses, since like the baseline level of diversity is just so much larger for them. But yeah, and so a second thing that your models have done is like tracking the emergence and extinction of species over time. What mathematical rules can govern the birth and death of species?
That's a very good question. So as you alluded to, there is a common way of picturing diversification of species is to see them as particles that can just like give birth, like split into two new species, or one species remains like the mother species and gives rise to a daughter species and can go extinct. And so if you have this picture in mind, you can really represent the phylogenetic tree, the tree of species, as the result of this kind of what's called the birth-death process, which is basically used for usually for you know, individuals rather than for species. And of course, the problem that you have is that the birth of a species and the death of a species is strongly related to internal variables, like, you know, its genetic composition the ability of, as we said earlier, the ability of its members to interbreed, the frequency with which they interbreed, their spatial structure, etc. And so the minimal ingredients that you have to take into account if you don't want to stick to this idea that a species is the particle is, you know, how individuals inside the species diverge genetically with respect to each other. And so, you know, this genetic composition inside the species is quite, you know, interesting to model because it's the result of many antagonistic forces, the first of which is just interbreeding itself, because, you know, the ability to interbreed generates similarity inside the species, whereas when you have a species which is spread into several isolates, then you can imagine that these isolates progressively diverge from each other because they don't exchange genes. And so there is a delicate, you know, equilibrium between divergence caused by, you know, the isolation of populations, and the similarity that increases when these isolates still start again to interbreed.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, maybe the internal variable that is very important for the modeling of speciation and extinction is how many such populations that are like beginning to diverge you want to model, you want to take into account.
Okay. And when you construct some of these more abstracted models, what kind of questions do they allow you to answer? Like if I tell you, what's the average lifespan of a species, for example, could you answer that?
Yeah, so one thing that we did, for example, is so model a species with the minimal number of ingredients, taking into account this distribution of a species into several populations, with the idea that these populations can themselves found new populations and diverge progressively with respect to the ancestral population as they accumulate mutations, say. And if you measure speciation time, or if you define the time it takes for a species to give rise to a new species as the first time when one of these populations that constitute the species is reproductively isolated from the others, then what we did is to analyze phylogenies and to study real phylogenies under this model and fit our model to, I think it was bird phylogenies. And for like many bird families, we had different estimates of this time to speciation. And what we found is something that ranged from 10,000 years to 10 million years. So just with, I think it was something between 40 and 50 phylogenies, just with these with this set of phylogenies, we were able under this model to estimate the time it takes for a new species to arise from a set of progressively diverging populations.
Well, okay, yeah, that's a large range. Given the number of the total number of species in the world today, can we somehow infer what the total species number has been in the history of life? Has it just undergone boom and bust cycles? Like how close are we to the peak? Do we know that kind of stuff?
Yeah, so what we find when we analyze phylogenies with the birth death models, or when we search into a fossil data, we know that the number of species has gone through, as you said, a series of booms and busts. Most of the busts come from, abiotic conditions like mass extinctions. But away from mass extinction events, it seems that the number of species inside a given family or class has a tendency to increase constantly. That's a common observation. There is also kind of there are some also bursts or booms of numbers of species that can arise at some points, adaptive radiations. There were evolutionary biologists who even hypothesized the fact that evolution, macroevolution, so the evolution of species, goes into this kind of periods of stasis and sudden, burst of numbers of species, and that was the rule. These guys were Eldredge and Gould. I'm sure your listeners know them. It's a theory that has recently been brought back to the interest of the evolutionary biologists with the help, sophisticated models for phenotypic evolution, trying to see whether phenotypes could undergo jumps in the history of a big group of species. So something that we've done with my group, not for phenotypes, but for genotypes. So we studied, you know, the possibility that at some points in time, you know, there are events which are instantaneous in the paleontological timescale, where you see genomes like accumulate a large number of mutations suddenly.
Okay, and yeah, going back to those reconstructing phylogenies, one thing I found in your papers was that was interesting was like given a certain sequence to infer how many ancestral sequences contributed to that one. So I was wondering if you could briefly describe like mathematically how you do that.
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, so it's not really the number of ancestors to one sequence, because one sequence has always a single ancestor at each point backwards in time. If you forget about, you know, insertions, deletions, and these kind of things, where you may want to like to track like all the ancestors of these bits of the sequence that may have merged to form the new sequence. But if you follow your genes, they either come from your mother or father, and those who come from your mother come from one of your two grandparents, etc. And so you can like really track them as a single lineage backwards in time. But your whole genome, of course, some bits pass through your mother, some bits pass through your father, and you can iterate this observation. Actually, this is also true for species, because if you follow the genome of one single individual in a given species today, then like all these chunks of her genome have passed through different individuals. But species can sometimes, in the paleontological timescale, exchange genes. Then actually these chunks of genome that are ancestral to your genome were not only like traveling in different individuals in the past, but also in different individuals of different species. And so that's why we don't have a single ancestor at each point in the past, but we also have various species ancestral to our genome in the past. Our idea in this paper was to, instead of tracking the ancestral species to a given species today, to track all the possible ancestral species, meaning all the species that has carried some chunk of the ancestors of the genomes that are present in the given species today.
Okay.
I don't know if I'm clear.
Yeah, but so I'm thinking, if you're trying to retrace the path in time, it may be that the most, the path that is adopted is not the most efficient one. This is just making me think of, there's this concept in algorithmic information theory, which maybe you know about, like called Marggraf complexity, which essentially like in computer programming, it's like the shortest computer program that produces an output. So if you think of like the shortest mutational path or the shortest like gene exchange path that produces a genome, you typically see that there's a bias towards these like low complexity and like efficient in evolution.
Yeah, I see what you mean. But I think that here, what would be a law of complexity must be replaced by this idea that the dimension of, the space of all possible genomes is so large, is so high, that when genomes accumulate mutations in independently evolving populations, they tend to diverge, right? They tend to, you never like encounter the same genome again. And so what happens is that, and the second element that you have to add is that when genomes are too divergent, they cannot interbreed, right? If they are harbored by individuals that are, in let's say in the same species or in closely related species, if their genomes are too divergent, then they cannot interbreed. Okay, the ability to interbreed decreases with genetic distance or genomic distance. Okay, and so if you think of these two elements, if you combine these two elements, then what you see is that you cannot have too many ancestral species. Because if it was the case, if you had like many ancestral species, then your gene lineages would have accumulated too many mutations to be brought back into the same genome of the same individual today. So what happens is that even if when you trace gene lineages of the same genome today, you must think that they have, you know, traveled between different species. They cannot have traveled into too many different species. And so what we've done is to design a model that prevents, because it's biologically realistic, that prevents the gene ancestral, the lineages ancestral to your genome to travel in too many different species.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and when you spoke about the space of possible sequences being so infinitely large, I guess it just touches on all the contingency there is in evolution, which, I mean, your group uses stochastic models, so it's apt to deal with that, but can you reach very good levels of confidence that do match the experimental data well? Like, so you've mentioned the examples of birds, but in general, can we really make confident models given like such potential sample paths?
Yeah, so you touch upon a very delicate question here, which is that, you know, usually when we model phenomena, at least in, like, for example, in physics, if we have a simple model that explains the experimental data, then we are satisfied with the model, right? Because actually we don't need to know whether the model is true or not. We just need it to be predictive, okay? Whereas in biology, we really want to know whether the model that we designed or that we inferred is an accurate description of what actually occurs. And for example, there are many examples where you want to infer the model that is the simplest possible and that explains well the data, and sometimes you're completely off map because the simplest model is not at all the right description of the phenomenon that you're observing. And so that's one big obstacle to let's say modeling in evolution, because we want to have a good idea of what actually occurred, and it may not be the simplest model that is the right one. So that's the problem. Of course, the main problem that I should have stated first is that most of the time we cannot redo the experiment. And that's a famous question that was also asked by Stephen Jay Gould, is if you replay the tape of life, do you expect to see the same thing as what happened on Earth? And so I don't think that people would, like most evolutionary biologists would say yes. I think that most evolutionary biologists would say no. They would say maybe we would see similar morphologies, but we wouldn't see exactly the same happen, right? And so that's a ceiling to the to the work of doing models of evolution.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, yeah, replaying the tape of life is fascinating. Maybe you're aware of Richard Lenski's long-term evolution experiment.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Maybe remind it for the listeners. This experiment that aimed to like replay the tape of life on a microscopic scale by culturing E. coli, so just bacteria, for thousands and thousands of generations and seeing what traits would evolve, what would happen to them. I think one thing I remember about it was some things they did observe, like they had better utilization of glucose. But one thing they studied was like citrate utilization. So it's just another carbon source and E. coli typically don't use it. And at some point, it must have been like 30,000 generations or something. And by that time, the bacteria had still not evolved the ability to use citrate, even though they'd had billions of mutations. So sampled like every single space in the genome several times. And that made them realize that it's not just about the frequency of the mutation, but it's about the previous like history of the mutations. So I guess it also shows that order matters and there's like a historical contingency in what emerges. Maybe you also observe that in your models, like how much does the order of mutation or the events matter?
Yeah, so there are two things that I would like to say. One is an empirical observation, is that there are many paths to a given phenotype or a given genotype. And there has been a wealth of studies of, experimental evolution, not only the long-term evolutionary experiment of Lenski, but also, experiments when you subject some I don't know, bacteria to antibiotics or to some phages, and you test all the possible orders of say 4, 5, 10 mutations that they have to go through until they find the optimal genotype, and you find that there's many paths, but usually there are like there's a couple of paths that accumulate most of the likelihood, a small number of paths that the you know the bacteria really take. And so it's something that we have to take into account in our models, because you know, it's called epistasis, how mutations like interact with each other. So the idea which is important to have in mind behind this this observation of this type of experiment is the fact that if you mutate B after A or after C or before C and after A, then what you can like increase your fitness or decrease it. You know, like it's you have to have in mind that it's like, you know, going from one peak to another peak, you have to cross a valley or this kind of, you know, this kind of image. And so we have to take this into account. And what we do is also to, you know, model this epistasis, this interaction between mutations, and see if, you know, by seeing the result of the experiment, we can detect this epistasis. So if you have a phylogeny, for example, and you have, I don't know, like, you know, a bunch of bacterial species that are, or bacterial species that are or are not resistant to some given antibiotic, and you study how their genomes have evolved through time, and you can spot in the phylogeny when they got resistant to the antibiotic, and you can try to pinpoint, you know, the mutations that occurred pretty much, you know, at the same time when they acquired the resistance, and this way you get this dependence between the phenotype and the genotype, or you can also track epistasis between two mutations in two different genes by doing the same type of trick. And so that's for you know, like modeling epistasis or dependence between genotypes or between phenotype and genotype. But the second thing that I wanted to say is that there is not only historical contingency, that there is also, you know, all the past of, you know, these bacteria that Lenski is studying. Their genomes have been shaped by their you know, previous evolutionary history during billions of years, and this makes, you know, this makes a hard trick for the modeler, because it means that the system it deals with, even the simplest one, which is, you know, the metabolism of a bacterium, is you know, is impossible to model, right? It's impossible to model, and notably, I would like to refer to, you know, the let's say the founder of EvoDevo, Conrad Reddington, who wrote that even if species were, you know, or if mutations were blind to the environmental conditions, as the modern synthesis of evolution states, the millions of years of history of highly evolved organisms had a consequence, which is the effect of mutations was not random. So maybe the mutations themselves, the mutations are not you know, are blind to the new environmental conditions they are embedded into, but the effects of the mutations have been shaped by evolution itself, and that's something that's really hard to model. Something that I've been interested in quite recently.
Yeah, I also don't come from a mathematical background, so I wouldn't know exactly when you say impossible to model, but I guess some of what you're using are Markov chains, and they're typically said to be memoryless in that they only depend on, like, basically the state of time t plus one depends simply on time t. So in that, you kind of lose the complexity of past histories. You only have the present one.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So what modelers do and mathematicians do is they usually, like, use Markov processes or Markov chains, because they are, you know, the only ingredient that you need is the transition probability from state at time t to the state at time t plus one. And of course, when you when you deal with a process which has not this you know, this lack of memory property, you have to, you know, enlarge the state space. So for example, if you know, the transition from you know, the phenotype at time t to the phenotype at time t plus one is not you know, it's not Markovian, maybe it means that you need more information to decide how you will make a transition from state at time t to time t plus one. And maybe if you know the genotype, then you know how the phenotype will change, because the genotype itself is more reasonable to think that it has no memory. Whereas the phenotype may have a memory through the memory of its genotype, the genotype that has produced it.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, at a higher order level, what are like the biggest obstacles in the modeling you face?
So there are mathematical obstacles. For example, if you want to you know, infer the ancestral state of species which is ancestral to some set of contemporary species, or to the state of the population even, like, I don't know, 100 years ago, you would need like a mathematical model that tells you that, right? So what is the state in the past conditional on the present? Mm-hmm. And that's something that sometimes works. That it's called, for example, the coalescence theory. Does that you're given a set of you know, a set of genotypes, and you are a set of, you know, individuals, and you want to have a sense of their genealogy. The coalescence theory is a mathematical theory that does that. But most of the time, you cannot do that, right? Because what you have your fingers on is really the law of you know, the process, how it unfolds through time from the past to the future. But there are so many paths that go from an unknown ancestral state to the present state, that there's no mathematical tool that can allow you to do that, you know, analytically. And so you try to do that computationally. That the second kind of obstacle is that the size, you know, of the dimension of the objects that we are looking at, that we are studying, is so large that we cannot even do that computationally.
Yeah, and it's also, I guess, always a trade-off between mathematical, like, tractability for your model to work, and then biological relevance. And I guess personally, as a biologist, reading some of the assumptions in the papers, you almost like want to tear your hair out. Things like all mutations have no effect on fitness, or like all mutations result in a new allele. Whereas, of course, the critical thing is like the impact on protein structure and the resulting change in fitness.
Yeah, totally.
But you still, I mean, yeah, obviously you're still deriving meaningful conclusions despite these like gross assumptions.
Yeah. Yeah, actually. So I have had, you know, tough times with you know, giving talks in front of, you know, biologists who are not evolutionary biologists, and who are like totally, you know, horrified by the assumptions that we made. Yeah, but so, for example, I think that the idea of neutral evolution is really like is foreign to most biologists, whereas for evolutionary biologists, it's a fundamental notion.
Back to the impact on fitness. The proportion of the genome that actually encodes protein is like a very minor, like 1 to 2%, which was one of the surprises of the Human Genome Project. How about all the sequences that are like very repetitive, like allele repeats or things that derive from retroviruses? Can they still be of use for you?
Yeah, so they can be of use because they evolve pretty neutrally. And they are also of use because I don't know if like there are as many people interested in that, but you can surely try to infer when they were inserted. And so, yeah, I mean, that's a very interesting biological phenomenon itself. And so, you know, by tracking, you know, how many mutations they have acquired since, you know, the last common ancestor of a group of individuals, you can infer whether, you know, the insertion is was earlier, was more recent or more ancient than the most recent common ancestor of these individuals.
But is there a particular part of the genome that's like a common benchmark to validate findings? Like in, for bacteria, for example, the ribosomal gene 16S RNA is like typically used because it has both highly conserved and highly variable regions. So is there an equivalent gene that you use maybe for like mammals or humans?
Like a neutral marker that that's used for like for barcode for barcoding,
essentially.
Yeah, so there's a gene called CO1. I think it's cytochrome oxidase one, something like this.
Well, I guess yeah, your models are more concerned with retracing lineage than evolutionary pressures, but the types of evolutionary pressures that genes are under are very different. Like for example, some of them would be like processing a nutrient source like lactase, which is studied a lot in population genetics, versus like an immunity gene that's only maybe going to be important when there's one pandemic. Do you study these kind of marks?
So what we tend to do is more to you know, design like quite generic models, and when we do that, we have like, you know, classes of mutations. So what we do is like we collapse mutations, all types of mutations into those mutations which are frequent and let's say with a low consequence on fitness, those which are a little more frequent, those which are less frequent but maybe have a large effect on fitness, or those which are like frequent will have zero effect on fitness. We have this classification of mutations without really tracking them on the genome. But maybe then the use of our models will be to infer which are the mutations that fall into such class. Yeah.
We've spoken a lot about species, but you said precisely your models are quite abstracted, so I guess they could be repurposed to many things. What if some like biological process that have some evolutionary component that you're interested in extending your models to?
That's a very good question. Actually, so we are now trying to address questions in a somatic evolution, which is the evolution of cells in the soma. There are like very famous examples of such evolutionary processes in the soma, the first of which is cancer. So it's becoming a quite fashionable topic for evolutionary biologists to tackle, which is to see, tumorigenesis as a process where tumor cells can get beneficial mutations. Of course, these beneficial mutations are only for the cells, not for the host. Another example is antibody maturation, antibody affinity maturation. Sorry, this is really like an amazing process of Darwinian evolution, which is controlled by the soma what is called directed evolution, where you really want to get a phenotype which is have an affinity for some antigen, and so there is a process which goes into several rounds of mutations and of testing of the antibodies until you get an antibody which is efficient and binds to the antigen. This process is not very clearly known. We don't know how these rounds proceed and how selection proceeds, if there are many bottlenecks, or if you have to have a like, very good affinity to be selected or not. This is still a process that is being studied. And so we also try to contribute to this topic. And a third example is really what is called somatic mosaicism, which is the recent observation that our cells actually acquire many mutations, the genomes of our cells acquire many mutations during development and homeostasis. And by applying phylogenetic methods to single cell sequencing inside the body, we can retrace the history of the first divisions from the egg cell to the blastocyst, etc. And there have been actually a wealth of papers doing this in 2021, last year. There may be 7 or 8 papers, like all published in Nature or Science, exactly doing this, like lineage tracing in the body. But there is a there's actually I think a lack of understanding of what's the role of selection in this process. The usual paradigm is that an instruction which is given to cells to divide at the right time in the right place. But of course, I think that, you know, because cells have different types or states, and these which are heritable or partially heritable after division, and that these states confer them, you know, a differential ability to proliferate or die. It really means that, you know, the development of an organism is an evolutionary process, right? It has all the Darwinian properties interacting at the same time. Of course, this process is itself under the control of Darwinian selection at the level of the organism itself. But I think there's a lack of understanding of how these two, you know, levels of Darwinian processes interact.
And it's true, actually, understanding, I mean, especially with your second examples of antibodies, that literally gives us the ability to like re-engineer the right evolutionary pressures, and like has a ton of clinical applications. And especially in cancer immunotherapy, I know there's many receptors that like, they don't have enough affinity before you do these rounds of selections, and then you can produce the therapeutic once you've re-engineered that. It's important to not see it as a black box process if you want to repurpose it after, hence the need to really understand it. I had another question for you, and I wanted to know, so obviously mathematics brings tools to biology, but at a higher level, in more in the approach and the philosophy, what do you think maths has to bring to biology? The way I'm asking that is I recently read a paper, like it's a 2002 paper by Lezebnik. It's kind of facetious, but he's describing a broken radio and seeing whether a biologist could fix it. And essentially what he describes is that with the current approaches of biology, we could not fix this radio, even though the engineering problem is known. And so how do we expect to fix things we don't even know how they should be fixed when we can't even fix something that like we do know how to be fixed? And one of his arguments was that biologists, they try to solve problems that need calculus with linear maths, and just think that if they repeat the problem enough, it'll just like remove the need for maths and just some standardization. And it made me think of, are there some fundamental flaws in the way that we practice biology that could maybe be like cured by philosophies from other disciplines?
Yeah. Usually my you know, way of seeing the difference between mathematicians and biologists is that I'm impressed by how biologists think about, you know, the biological reality, and how they understand its complexity and how they embrace it, as compared to how mathematicians tend to oversimplify everything and see, you know, always the generic properties of systems. And it reminds me, you know, of you know, this paper by François Jacob saying that evolution is tinkering. Mm-hmm. So evolution is really tinkering, like trying to face new challenges or environmental challenges only with what it has, and finding the most immediate solution, even if it's not the optimal solution. And I heard also maybe it's I can't remember who said that, but heard someone say that it's even worse, that evolution is not a tinkerer, but it's really a tinkerer, with a crazy assistant trying to, you know, destroy all what it has found, and trying, you know, to invent the most possible complex tricks, or the most complex devices, you know, let a sugar, you know, fall into the cup of tea at the right time, you know, this kind of cartoon cartoon representation. And so for mathematicians, I think it's hard to represent, to have a right representation of this tinkering. And that's where I think, I'm not answering your question. I'm saying actually the people who are not biologists are not prepared to understand it. In the other direction.
Well, yeah, I mean, already what you say about, as a biologist, I would say I become comfortable with like local and partial truths in some sense. I know you can't have some like exhaustive theory of everything type of explanations for biological phenomena. It'll always be like a partial suboptimal explanation of something in a specific space at a specific time. That it doesn't mean, obviously it doesn't have the beautiful simplicity of a mathematical proof, but that doesn't mean it's like less beautiful in some regards.
Yeah, that's interesting to think, as scientists, interesting to think of beauty in what we handle. I think that as a, let's say, mathematical biologist, I think I see beauty in both math and biology, in both math and the living. Maybe one of my characteristics is to see, you know, the, as I said previously, the generic characters in some characteristics in some, you know, systems or some biological systems. I mean, but I think I couldn't do math if I was not convinced of the beauty of a mathematical problem and of its solution and even of its proof. But of course, it's quite orthogonal to the beauty to which I'm also very sensitive, the beauty of the living, which is beautiful by its complexity, and exactly by the contrary of the math is that the fact that we cannot, you know, embrace it as a whole, and you know the inventivity of evolution, you know, the its creativity. But I think that in math there's also actually a similar feature, which is when you have this feeling of discovering something, and maybe the what is a little bit I think more like a little bit like deeper and the more and stronger, you know, in math is that when you discover something, you're sure of what you've discovered, right? You have no doubt. Whereas in biology, there's still a doubt. I mean, there's always the paradigm can be, you know, challenged by some new discovery, and you're never sure of what you. Of course, that's even worse for me as a modeler. But even for experimentalists, they are never sure of what they discovered, unless you know you have like an X-ray picture of the. You know, a helix structure of DNA, but most of the time you're never sure. Mm-hmm. And in math, you know, when you discover a new landscape and you have new grasp of objects that were recently defined, you can really have this same kind of contemplation feeling that you have when you see a beautiful ecosystem.
Mm-hmm. That's a great way to end it. And I think we shouldn't shy away from like using words like beauty and so on in science, because ultimately that's probably what drives us to do it. And it doesn't have to be like a wishy-washy thing to seek for beauty and elegance in science. thank you so much for this conversation.
I'd like to finish off by reading a few lines from François Jacob's Le Jeu des Possibles, translated as The Possible and the Actual, where he develops the metaphor of evolution as a tinkerer. Natural selection has no analogy with any aspect of human behavior. However, if one wanted to play with a comparison, one would have to say that natural selection does not work as an engineer works. It works like a tinkerer. A tinkerer who does not know exactly what he's going to produce, but uses whatever he finds around him, whether it be pieces of string, fragments of wood, or old cardboards. In short, it works like a tinkerer who uses everything at his disposal to produce some kind of workable object. For the engineer, the realization of his task depends on his having the raw materials and the tools that exactly fit his project. The tinkerer, in contrast, always manages with odds and ends. What he ultimately produces is generally related to no special project, and it results from a series of contingent events, of all the opportunities he had to enrich his stock with leftovers. In contrast with the engineer's tools, those of the tinkerer cannot be defined by a project. What these objects have in common is, it might well be of some use. For what? That depends on the opportunities.